MacCast, Monday, February 20th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hey, I'm glad to have you back here with me once again, talking about all things Mac and Apple. I hope you're having a great week. I guess it's the start of the week. Some interesting things going on last week. Toward the end of the week, Apple slipped in a nice little announcement for us, a new version of the operating system. What do you know? OS X Mountain Lion. We're going to be talking about that in this episode, along with, of course, iPad 3 rumors and some other stuff. I got some great feedback and comments from you. Lots of great stuff to get into. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I've talked to you a lot about Notebook. It's a great application. I use it for doing my show prep, for doing research, collecting notes and things like that. And it's great for that. But another great use for it is if you are doing any kind of planning, if you're planning for a trip or you're planning for an event, something like that, has a bunch of great built-in features that you can use and take advantage of for that sort of task. So you can do things like you could make lists. You can, of course, take notes in it. And along with those notes, you can add in links. And so if you've gone out and you've found resources on websites, maybe a location or some services that you want to take advantage of, you can add in links, automatically clip those into your notebook, and you get link backs. Not only that, you get your multi-dex indexing, so you get a page that has just your links in it. You can go back and reference that. You can put in other clippings, so if you want to, if you find photos or things that you might want to pick up, you can simply drag those into your notebook pages and move those around. You can add annotations to that. You can draw on top of it. You can add sticky notes. You can do basically everything that you would do in a physical notebook, but virtually there on the Mac. And they have this really great interface. It looks just like a physical notebook. You can have all different kinds of papers and different types of bindings and stuff like that. However you want to set up your notebook, you can completely customize it. And then along with that, for doing things like planning, a great feature that it has is when you're creating your lists, you can create action items. And you can assign dates to those. They can just be simple to-dos. You can have checkboxes, so you can mark them off as you're working through your project or doing your planning. And not only that, but you can turn on syncing of those pages with iCal. So any of your action items, any of your to-dos or due dates or things like that will show up automatically as events and to-dos in iCal. And changes to iCal or changes to your notebook will be synced across and reflected in either location. So that makes it really easy to sort of manage this stuff, to move back and forth. And that's the kind of power and ease of use that Notebook brings. And so it's just a really great app. If you haven't checked it out, you really should. Very versatile. You can get free trials. They're available on their website. Get more information and details over at circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So I think that the big news that we need to talk about that happened late last week was Apple's announcement of OS X Mountain Lion, OS X 10.8. They kind of quietly rolled it out there. Of course, Apple pushed it out quietly, but then the media immediately exploded. There was some hints kind of going into Thursday, kind of late Wednesday, we were hearing some hints and rumors that Apple might be getting ready to do something. And that's not surprising because Apple actually did something completely unprecedented. They held pre-brief meetings with select members of the media. Guys like John Gruber got invited into these private meetings with Phil Schiller. What was interesting is Gruber had a great post on his site talking about the whole experience. And he said basically it was like an Apple keynote, just like any one of their other events, but it was one-to-one. You had Phil Schiller there. He was totally prepped. He had his keynote slide deck, and he went through all the standard things, the introduction, talking about where Apple was, how they'd been doing financially, and what they were going to do moving forward. Told him about Mountain Lion, and then proceeded to say, well, we're not going to show you everything in Mountain Lion. There's 100 new features, and we're going to focus today on just 10. And if you've ever seen one of Apple's keynote presentations like they do at WWDC. That's exactly how it goes. And Gruber said it was a little bit surreal. It's a great post. You should check it out on his website. So Apple made the announcement, and one of the things you might have noticed immediately when you were reading all the articles was a slight change to the naming. Apple is actually dropping Mac from the OS X naming, and it's just simply called OS X Mountain Lion instead of Mac OS X Mountain Lion. The other thing Apple announced along with this is that they are committing to a yearly release schedule for the operating system. So let's hope that if they're going to do that, they're going to continue their existing pricing that we saw with Lion, $29.99 US to do the upgrade. It's going to get very expensive otherwise. I hope they don't go back to the $129 price point. And there doesn't seem to be any indication that they will. The rumors and speculation is that Apple will continue with the $29.99 pricing. We're going to get a new operating system every year. And that's a very aggressive release schedule. So it's interesting to hear Apple coming out publicly and saying that we're going to commit to that. That was something they traditionally hadn't done in the past. And they did update their website, so I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. They've got videos up there. You can check out all the stuff that I'm talking about and get more details from Apple. But one of the first things that I was very excited about and noticed right after the announcement was that they are standardizing, it seems like they're standardizing the built-in applications and the functionality between Mac OS X and iOS. Apple is kind of saying that, you know, they're borrowing kind of the best concepts from each operating system and that we're going to see a lot of this kind of moving functionality back and forth. In the case of Mountain Lion, it looks like a lot of the things that they've been doing on iOS, or several of the key things that they've been doing on iOS, are kind of making their way back into Mac OS X, this whole back to the Mac kind of concept that they started with Lion. And so one of the things that I really like is that they're making all the applications the same across both platforms and really focusing each app on its core functionality. So they're going to take notes, which is one of those things that's been in mail and kind of confusing for a lot of people. Why are these notes in my mail? They're taking notes finally out of mail on the desktop. It's going to get its own application, and it's going to be simply called Notes, just like it is on iOS. They're taking to-dos and pulling those out of iCal, and now you have an app on Mac OS X in Mountain Lion called Reminders, just like Reminders on iOS. iCal is actually being renamed to Calendar, again, keeping consistency across both platforms. And in a similar note, Address Book becomes simply Contacts on Mac OS X. And then Messages, something that I had been speculating about, really hoping that Apple was going to do, Messages is finally coming to Mac OS X and replacing iChat, or actually kind of merging with iChat. And it's all coming together under a simple one message application, and that's going to have your iCal and iMessage, and it integrates with FaceTime. FaceTime is not built into it, but you can launch a FaceTime call directly from the application. So your iMessages that you're sending and receiving on your iOS devices, you can also pick up on your Mac. So I really liked seeing all that come together. Some additional applications kind of making their way over, or concepts making their way over from iOS. Notifications. So the Mac is now going to have its own version of Notification Center, also Twitter integration, Game Center, and a lot of people, including myself, are very excited about AirPlay mirroring coming to Mac OS X. So you're going to be able to take your Mac, take an Apple TV that's hooked up to a large screen HD television, and wirelessly mirror your presentations, your Mac desktop, over to that system. So that should be very, very cool. On the notification side, of things, you might be wondering a little bit about how that works. Notifications, you're actually going to have a new system preference pane where you're going to be able to control those, very similar to the way that you can control notifications on an app-by-app basis. In iOS, you're going to be able to set that up. You can have two different styles. So you can have either banners or alerts. Banners are going to kind of pop up and fade away up in the corner of your desktop. I'm not sure if you can customize that. I think you actually can probably customize the location, but seemed like most of the screenshots I was seeing was up in the upper right. So kind of very, a lot of people are saying growl style, and I think growl has responded to say, you know, we're still going to be around. This isn't going to replace what we're doing, but a lot of people are drawing that comparison. But then alerts are going to actually pop up in the middle of the screen. And the main difference is that the banners will come in and fade away, whereas alerts you're going to have to actually dismiss before you can move on. A little bit more modal, I think, in terms of how they work. And to get to your notifications once they've gone away, there is a little sidebar sheet that you can kind of pull out. There'll be an icon in the menu bar that you can tap to bring that out. I think also a keyboard shortcut or a new swipe gesture where you swipe from the left of your trackpad with two fingers, swipe over, and you can slide that little sheet out from the side, get all of your prior notifications. Of course, along with all of this, a big part of it is going to be syncing, and that is more iCloud support making its way into OS X Mountain Lion. And another key feature that, you know, is there in Lion right now, but really isn't integrated across too many apps, is documents and documents in the cloud. And actually, that comes kind of to the forefront in applications in Mountain Lion. They're going to have a new open save dialog box, and it actually kind of now has two little tabs, one of them being documents in the cloud, and you'll get that kind of documents in the cloud style view that we're used to seeing in the iOS iWork applications, that kind of sheet where you get the little thumbnails and you'll be able to save your documents right into there and they'll go right up into the cloud and sync across. And then you'll also have an On My Mac tab to switch between the two different views. And I haven't seen any screenshots of the On My Mac tab. I'm not sure if that's just because Apple hasn't released them. I would assume it looks like your standard OpenSave dialog that we have in Mac OS X now, or at least that's my hope. There's also going to be a new Sharings Actions button, and that, again, looks like that familiar icon we're used to where you have the little box with the kind of arrow jumping out of it. Clicking on that is how you'll access things like the Twitter integration. There's also going to be built-in sharing for other types of services like Vimeo, YouTube, also sending stuff over to messages or your reading list. Does not look like there's any integrated built-in Facebook stuff within the sharing, at least not yet, but I would imagine that would be something that could be added. And what you can share and where you can share it is obviously going to change depending upon the application and the features that they want to implement. Another big new feature of OS X Mountain Lion is something that's a little more under the hood, but brings security a little bit more to the forefront, actually, for consumers, and also it makes it something that I think developers are going to really want to implement into their applications. And that's technology called Gatekeeper. Now, I did a special MacCast members episode where I really delved into Gatekeeper and potentially what it means for you as a Mac user running OS X Lion. So if you'd like to check that out, you can get information at member.maccast.com on how to sign up to become a MacCast member. But in essence, what it should do is allow better protection within the operating system from launching applications that you download from different online sources, either through your web browser, maybe get through an email link, something like that, protect you from launching anything that might be malicious and could do damage on your system. And the way that it works, there's a couple key features built into it. One of them is that developers can get an ID from Apple. And once they have that ID, they can use that to digitally sign their applications. And what that means is once they've done that, we have the ability, or actually the operating system now has the ability, to check that ID and make sure that that code is from that developer, is verified, and that they're registered with Apple, and that also the code hasn't been tampered with since that program was built. It's going to be a requirement for developers who want to sell their applications through the Mac App Store to get an Apple ID and to sign their code. As a matter of fact, I think that's something that's already in place. But now developers, any developer can get an ID, they can sign their code, and they can distribute that code any way that they want. They don't have to use the Mac App Store. They can continue to sell it through their site or through some other source. And then when you download it, the first time that you launch it, Apple is actually leveraging a technology that's already built into Mac OS X Lion. If you've ever launched an application that you've downloaded from an online source, and you know that little dialog box that pops up and says, hey, you've downloaded this from the internet, are you sure you want to run this? It kind of stops you right before you launch it. It'll do a similar style check, but it'll check the ID and check to see if it's a registered developer, depending upon how you have your settings set in Mountain Lion. And that's another key to this, and something that I really like, is that you're in control of deciding what kinds of applications you want to allow to run on the operating system. And there's going to be three different settings. There's going to be one called Anywhere, which means that it will let you download, install, and launch applications from anywhere, regardless of whether or not they're signed by a developer or not. So if you just want to say, you know what, I'm going to throw caution into the wind, I'm going to run whatever I want, you can set OS X Mountain Lion in that mode. On the other end of the scale, there is a mode called Mac App Store Only, and you do all this from the system preferences. There's a new tab in the security system preferences, and you can choose Mac App Store, and that will allow you to only download and run applications that are purchased through the Mac App Store. And then the default setting, and kind of the one I think most people are going to choose to stick with, is a mode that says, okay, I will allow to run any applications purchased through the Mac App Store or any applications that I download that have a valid developer Apple ID, that are signed applications. And this happens on the first launch after you download the application. Apple maintains a list, and if a developer's code is found to be malicious or doing something bad, they can actually revoke the signature, revoke the ID, and that will prevent the application from launching, assuming that you've set up the mode that says only allow the operating system to launch applications with a valid ID. And another nice thing that they've done is that, unlike the current method where it pops up the dialogue and if you don't read the dialogue and you just click OK, the application launches, with this new system, with Gatekeeper, the application won't launch. The dialogue comes up and says, look, you've set your settings, you can't launch this application, and that way it won't accidentally run and can't cause potential harm to your operating system. Now, there is an override for individual applications. So if you deem, you know what, I want to go ahead and run this, I don't care what my security settings are, you can actually control or right-click on the application, tell it to open, and it'll bypass for that launch the Gatekeeper restrictions. So gives a lot of control back to the users, also gives developers an easy way to take their code and sign it, doesn't force them into selling their apps through the Mac App Store, which is one of those things that I was very concerned about, a lot of developers are concerned about, because there's some restrictions for different types of applications within the Mac App Store that make it so certain applications actually can't be sold or need to be crippled, need to have functionality removed in order to work. And so we need the ability for developers to still sell apps outside the Mac App Store, but we want to be able to have also the security and protection from different types of malware as the Mac becomes a larger target. And I think that Gatekeeper strikes a nice balance between all of this. So I'm very excited about it. Generally, it seems like most developers who have been blogging or talking about this since the announcement are also very positive about it. You know, it's not going to protect every situation, and I'm sure there's going to be some people trying to game the system, but I think it's a step in the right direction. And actually, I have some amount of hope that if it's successful on the desktop, that maybe this is one of those features that might find its way from OS X back into iOS, allowing developers to distribute applications maybe outside the iOS App Store, and us to have a control on our iOS devices that says, you know what, I'm okay if I get something from outside the iOS App Store as long as it's signed code from a developer. And that still allows Apple to maintain a certain amount of control over revoking an ID. And there are some concerns from the development community about Apple might still have too much power with these IDs, because they're going to be able to set the rules on when they pull a certificate or an ID. And yeah, I think that is a risk, but I think that Apple is not going to be overly zealous about revoking IDs. I think it's only going to be when some code is actually truly doing something malicious or potentially damaging to the operating system, but only time will tell. And I'm sure there's going to be some of those false positives that we saw with like App Store rejections on the Mac App Store. So very excited about seeing how Apple does that. A few other little odds and ends, some interesting things that I noted about the Mountain Lion release as I've been reading things and as more information has become available. Somebody discovered a new core recognition framework and something called CR Code Redeemer, a class inside Mac OS X. I think some of the development tools, they released a new version of Xcode. And what it appears these are for is actually turning barcodes, or I would assume maybe QR codes, into app licenses. And it looks like what this is designed to do is allow Apple to distribute either cards or codes with a little barcode on it, and then you could use your Mac and your FaceTime camera to automatically download, install, or activate software or a movie or media from iTunes. And it could completely replace the, you know, redemption codes that we have now for entering in for things like Apple Store gift cards or iTunes gift cards, things like that. You'd be able to just hold it up to your FaceTime HD camera and boom, get instant access to whatever that item might be it credits for your iTunes Store account or a direct download maybe from a developer. And it'd be great because developers could have little cards that they could give out for free copies of their software, redemption codes, and things like that would be a thing of the past. You wouldn't have to do any more typing, eliminate human error, and just make the general user experience a little bit better. So that's pretty cool to see that kind of technology making its way into OS X. Another bit of news that is a little bit disappointing if you're a hardcore geek like me is it looks like X11 is no longer going to be built in or part of the operating system install by default. It's actually going to be something that is going to be an optional install. So if you install an application that requires X11, and in case you don't know, X11 is kind of the windowing system, the graphic layer that sits on top of a lot of open source Linux type programs that you can run on the Mac, things like GIMP, the graphic image manipulation program, use X11. That's not going to be installed by default, but just like Apple's done with Java and some of the other technologies that they've pulled out of the core of the operating system, sounds like when you go to launch an X11 application, the operating system will tell you and prompt you to go to an area of Apple's knowledge base to actually download X11 and get it installed on your system. Apple's going to continue to support X11 like it's done, again, with some of these other technologies by supporting something called XQuartz, and that's the open source project that develops the software that Apple uses as its own X11 package. So it's still going to be out there. They're going to point you to it. You'll be able to download it and run it. But the vast majority of users don't really leverage X11. So it kind of makes sense for that to be spun off outside the operating system and just made available for those people who need it on an as-need basis. So who can run Mountain Lion so far with the developer preview? You know, it's too early to tell the final specifications, but what we see with the current version that's available for developers is that you can upgrade from Snow Leopard. A lot of people have got a lot of emails asking me, will I be able to go directly from Snow Leopard right to Mountain Lion because I didn't buy Lion? It looks like, at least in the preview version, you can do that. So 10.6.8 or later to upgrade to Mountain Lion. As far as the hardware goes, the developer preview is supporting iMacs 2007 and later, Mac Minis 2009 and later, Mac Pros from 2008 and later, MacBooks from late 2008 and later, MacBook Airs, again, late 2008, later versions of those, the MacBook Pro 2007 and later models, and XServes, if you have one of those, 2009 and later models. So in essence, it looks to me like most Macs made within the last 4 to 5 years, with a few exceptions thrown in there. Not all machines that currently run Lion, though, are going to be able to run Mountain Lion. So depending upon the age of your system, you may be cut out of the Mountain Lion update. And as far as availability goes, interesting one. Apple kind of experimented with doing direct distribution through the Mac App Store upgrades with OS X Lion. Mountain Lion is going to be exclusively sold through the Mac App Store. So you do need to have the Mac App Store, and you need to download it through that and install it through that. They are not going to have physical media available like they did with Lion. And I guess from the reports that I read, the physical media, not too many people really wanted it. So that made Apple's decision of going pure direct digital through the Mac App Store, I guess, a little bit easier. Apple saying availability is going to be late summer 2012. So looking at the calendar, that could mean as late as September 22nd, almost the end of September. And Apple probably will push it all the way out to that date. I think they're getting Mountain Lion out now because they want developers to be able to start leveraging the technologies and getting ready to build their applications for Mountain Lion so that when the summer release comes around, everybody's ready and they can roll out their software. An interesting thing to note about the Mac App Store distribution, too, is I read several reports that noted that all of the OS X updates are now going to be pushed through the Mac App Store as well. I guess in Mountain Lion, if you run the software update, it actually launches the Mac App Store application and takes you to that upgrade pane in there. And then there's a section for your OS X updates. So it sounds like Apple's finally going to be consolidating that process and getting all of your OS updates through the Mac App Store application. And that's pretty much it. That's what I've got for you for Mountain Lion. I'm sure there's going to be more details coming out. As I mentioned earlier, some of the press got early versions of it, so there's been a lot of information, a lot more information with this release coming out earlier on than in the past, which I kind of like. There's a lot of information available. And also now that developers have it in their hands, I think we're going to be seeing and hearing about more and more features. So expect to get more Mountain Lion coverage on future episodes of the MacCast. As I mentioned earlier, many of the applications that are in iOS are now making their way to the Mac desktop, reminders, notes, and messages. And messages you can actually download and install now, along with the announcement of Mountain Lion. Apple also announced the release of the public beta version of messages for Lion. And I've downloaded it. I've been playing around with it. I actually like it a lot. It is definitely beta software, I can tell you that. It's still not very consistent for me in terms of my iMessages. Like, I have some that are on my phone that I can't figure out how to get on to the desktop. I think it's related to how you connect up the phone numbers and the email addresses that are associated with the different iMessages account that you have in your address book. My theory right now is that if you start the iMessage using the person's email address on any platform, it'll kind of show up every place. But if you've started an iMessage conversation on the phone using the person's phone number, that doesn't seem to kind of translate over to the Mac desktop version of the application. The other thing that is kind of kludgy, it seems like to me right now, about the Messages application is it still has AIM and all the other services, iChat, built into it, but they still kind of feel like separate things. You have Messages and iMessages that feel and look a lot like the iOS counterpart. And actually, when you start a conversation from iChat or AIM or some other service that you have integrated into the Messages application, it kind of pops up into a similar style window that you're used to seeing with the iOS version of Messages. But beyond that, the sort of buddy lists and things like that all still exist. They still look like the versions that you're used to having in iChat. So visually, I don't know why, to me, it feels a little bit like this hybrid mismatch. And I'm hoping that they'll figure out the UI a little bit better and make it a little bit cleaner and a little more seamless. But for now, basic functionality works, a little bit buggy in terms of sending messages back and forth. But so far, I really actually like it. And if you'd like to download it, I will have a link to it in the show notes up at maccast.com. But be warned, a French blog, Consumac, has reported finding some strings in the beta version that make it look like that once OS X Mountain Lion is released, the Lion beta version will actually expire and tell you that you need to upgrade to Mountain Lion if you want to continue to use the Messages application. Another thing that the blogs found out about as they were digging around in the Messages beta is that it does appear to have some double resolution, high-res graphics assets. And this is once again continuing to fuel the speculation that at some point Apple is going to come out with Macs, either iMacs or MacBook Pros or both, that have high DPI, high resolution, Retina style LCD displays. And it does seem, I think there was also some release of high resolution desktop backgrounds from Mountain Lion, something like 3200 by 2000 pixel desktop backgrounds. So it does seem like more and more graphics, more and more assets in Apple's applications moving forward are getting higher and higher resolution. And eventually we could, and it just seems like a natural progression to me, we could see higher resolution displays on our Macs in the future. Whether it'll happen this year, how soon it'll happen, who knows? But I think it definitely is on the horizon. It seems like Apple is prepping for that. So what do you think? It was kind of nice this week to actually get some real, actual stuff that wasn't rumors. Of course, the rumors are still floating around out there about what Apple is going to be doing next. And the Apple TV, the quote-unquote real Apple TV, is still out there. DigiTimes this week reported that Genesis Photonics is expected to supply the LED backlighting security for a Sharp panel that'll be used in the actual Apple TV. This seems to be, at this point, an early deal with Genesis, and it's in the very early stages of being put together. So speculation is that means production schedules for an Apple-branded TV would not be anything that would be coming to light anytime soon. And actually, they're predicting that the release of an Apple TV would be sometime in 2013, maybe early 2013. So their prediction is that based on this deal, you're not going to see Apple TVs this year. Now, that report was out there, and then there was kind of a, I don't know if it's a contradictory report or at least a report that looks like Apple might be getting ready to do something with the Apple TV. I'm assuming the little set-top box Apple TV, the Apple TV 2, because supplies are reportedly dwindling. The unofficial Apple weblog says that BestBuy.com and Walmart.com are no longer listing the Apple TV on their sites, and that the only Apple TVs available on Amazon.com are used devices. So typically when we start to see this kind of supply chain dry up, that usually means that Apple is getting ready or prepping for a new model. And so there's some speculation that Apple could be getting ready to do an updated Apple TV. I don't think that means that they're going to put out an actual physical TV. It's probably going to be some sort of rev to the current set-top box. So if you've been thinking about buying one of those, you might want to watch the blogs a little bit closely right now and see what might be happening. There's been some rumors that Apple might do some updated software, maybe bring applications to the set-top box Apple TV. And maybe that will be surfacing sometime soon. It could come along with the announcement of the iPad 3, because typically there is a software update that happens with that. So maybe this next generation iOS 5.1, along with a new update to the Apple TV, could come along with some new hardware. But we're going to have to stay tuned on that one. Now, I want you to think back a bit. Remember when the iPhone 4 came out and we were all excited, and then right afterwards, there started to be this little seed of doubt that this was a really great phone. Apple touted its great new design and this external antenna, and then people started saying, well, there's the death grip. And I think I was in this camp as well, because I noticed that there was this problem with my antenna, and we had this back and forth, and Apple came out and said, well, there's really no issue, but then still turned around and said, well, we'll give you a bumper anyway, a free bumper case to take care of the issue that's not really an issue. And yeah, remember all that? That was fun, right? And that was a long time ago. Well, guess what? This week it showed back up in the news, AntennaGate, but this time around it is the settlement of the AntennaGate lawsuit. So for all those people who didn't go out and take advantage of Apple's free bumper program, there was a class action lawsuit. There were actually 18 separate lawsuits that were drawn together into one class action complaint. Well, this week Apple announced that they have settled that lawsuit. Apple was accused of misrepresenting and concealing material information in the marketing, advertising, and sale of servicing of its iPhone 4. Apple, for its part, released a response after they settled the agreement and said that the settlement relates to only a small number of customers who indicated that they experienced antenna or reception issues with their iPhone 4 and didn't want to take advantage of the free case from Apple while it was being offered in 2010. So what's the amazing settlement that all these people that held out are going to get? A free bumper case. So I bet you they're really glad that they held out. Actually, that's not 100% accurate. You get your choice of a free bumper case or a $15 cash payout. So I guess you could take your 15 bucks and buy whatever case you want. But either way, it seems like a long time to wait to just get your free bumper case. But it's settled, and hopefully that will be the absolute end of it. We never have to hear about AntennaGate again. And yes, we're drawing ever closer and nearer to an official iPad 3 announcement. And as that happens, we get more and more leaks, more and more rumored information about what we're going to see in that next generation iPad 3. Mac Rumors this week reportedly got a hold of an iPad 3 display and has verified that it is the QXVGA 2048 by 1536 PPI resolution. They actually put the thing under a microscope and counted pixels. So you got four times the pixel density of the current generation displays, meeting that quote-unquote retina requirement. I think no doubt about it at this point that it's going to be double resolution 2048 by 1536 pixel display. I think it's going to be absolutely gorgeous and a significant bump up from the current generation iPads. A Chinese website reportedly has pictures of the iPad 3 logic board, and interestingly, it shows the processor labeled as an A5X, not an A6, as some people had expected. There had been rumors that the iPad 3 may feature a dual-core and not a quad-core processor. Earlier in the rumor cycle, we had heard that, you know, from some pretty reliable sources, that the next generation processor would be a quad core. Then I think it came out on The Verge that nope, it's actually going to be a dual core. And the naming, if it turns out to be accurate, would seem to indicate more of an incremental update to the A5 processor and not a whole new generation of chips. So that could support this idea that it is a dual core processor. Now, the board pictured in this leak looks like it was produced in November of 2011. So who knows? It could have been an earlier prototype. The labeling on the chip could be something that was simply placeholder, something that was there to kind of, just in case images did leak out, not really indicate what the processor was. The image also reportedly features two 16-gigabyte Hynix flash memory chips for the storage. So that is available online if you want to get a look at it. You know, even if the CPU isn't upgraded, it still stays the dual core. It sounds like it will get at least a speed bump in the dual core range. And most of the rumors seem to agree that the graphics processors are also going to be significantly upgraded. Those may end up actually being quad core. PowerVR has a model, the SGX543 MP4, which is a quad-core version of their GPUs, and that could be the processor driving the next generation iPad. I would imagine that the GPU bump would actually make games and the whole new display really shine. Apple had been reportedly talking to some pretty high-end game developers about having their games ready and available for the launch and the demo of the iPad 3. So it seems like there's going to be a heavy graphics focus on the new iPads, and no doubt we'll have a nice new GPU to go along with that. We also saw this week some new rear shell images. These came from a site called Next Media, and they do show that there is a larger camera opening on the rear case and also a more gradual taper of the back case. The larger camera lens seems to support the rumors that there is going to be an improved camera. Probably 5, but most of the sites are predicting 8-megapixel camera on the rear of the new iPad 3. And when you look at where the lens is positioned on these images, you'll notice that the tapered edge, that lens is actually on the tapered portion of the back of the iPad. So that's been significantly extended, which would allow for the extra thickness and maybe a little more room inside the case. Another thing that allows for a little more room inside the case is the thinness of the front glass. It's much thinner than the current generation iPad 2, and would support the theory that Apple's using Corning's new Gorilla Glass 2, which is significantly thinner. And so that's going to allow them to, again, get a little more internal dimensions along with the increased thickness. So maybe a bigger battery. It's been rumored and shown that the board, the actual logic board, is actually smaller. So that would support this theory that there's going to be a little more power under the hood, requiring a little more juice to keep things going and to still maintain the existing battery life of the iPad. And it is predicted that the next generation iPad 3 will have very similar, if not better, battery life than the current generation models. So either way, getting very excited about seeing what Apple's going to do with the new iPad. And not to be left out, the iPhone made its way into the rumor news this week. Japanese blog Mac Takahara claims that Apple will release the next generation iPhone in the fall. They say that Apple is going to launch the iPhone 5 in September or October and then stick to a yearly release cycle for the iPhone for years. If you remember, up until this year, Apple had released the iPhone in July, usually announcing it in the June timeframe and then releasing in July. That got pushed back to the fall this year. It sounds like Apple's going to continue to stay on that cycle, at least if this rumor's to be believed. And I think that makes sense, given the waning of the iPod. You know, sales of iPods is the one thing that is in Apple's lineup that's in decline. And in the past, the iPods were updated in the fall, carrying them into good holiday sales. This year, Apple had phenomenal holiday sales with the iPhone, and I think they're going to want to continue that trend. And so putting it on this sort of fall release cycle seems to make a lot of sense. Apple can continue to ramp up and deliver new iPhones and get those great sales numbers right there at the end of the year. And then the last news story I have for you today is about Apple and their data center in North Carolina, specifically how green it is. Apple has updated their Apple and the Environment webpage. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com in case you've never looked through it. But specifically, they added details about the green nature of their 500,000 square foot, $1 billion data center in Maiden, North Carolina. According to the site, the location has already received a Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Platinum certification. That's a LEED certification. And Apple is already planning to enhance the facility's environmentally friendly footprint. They say they've already received approval from the county to begin preparing 171 acres of land that's next to the data center for the installation of a solar array, and that solar array, once it's completed, will be the largest in the nation, the largest end-user-owned solar array in the country. Along with that, they also plan to build the largest non-utility fuel cell installation in the United States. So Apple trying to stay green, at least with respect to its data center facility. And I think they're kind of planning some similar kind of green, environmentally friendly designs for their new office space in Cupertino. So not unusual for Apple to be doing this kind of thing, but kind of cool to see what they're actually implementing and actually what they're putting together. And again, that all of that information is available up on Apple's website. So on the last episode of the MacCast, I had received a question from a listener who had been taking some photos through the address book application or the contact application. Going back, see, I'm still confused. Is it address book or contact? So I'm so glad that Mountain Lion is actually going to consolidate that. It is now contacts. Through the contacts application, he was taking some photos and adding them to contacts, but in his case, that was the only photo he had of a particular person. I believe it was a relative of his. It was only the photo that was in the contact application. So he had asked me for a way to actually extract the photo, the high-res photo, original one, from the contacts application and get it into the camera roll. And so I wasn't really sure how to do it. I figured out a couple different ways, including using an application called PasteBot. And I asked some of you if you knew of any other solutions, and I actually got this follow-up from Chris.
Hey, Adam. Chris Morse here, longtime listener, huge fan of the MacCast. Just got done listening to the February 11th, 2012 episode, and a listener had asked how to extract a photo from the native contact application on the iPhone when the photo had been actually taken in the application. So you had a suggestion to use PasteBot, which works fantastically, and PasteBot is a wonderful application. There's also another method that doesn't require a third-party application and uses the mail application that's native in the iPhone. So what you do is you'd follow the same instructions you had before. You'd go into the contact, touch and hold on the contact until you get the pop-up menu, and then select the option to copy the photo. Then you can go right into the native mail application on the iPhone, start a new message, and paste the image directly into the message, and mail the message. When you mail the message, you'll get the standard pop-up that asks what size you'd like to send the image in, and you can go ahead and select any of those sizes, including the actual size of the image. Go ahead and mail that, and the recipient, whom could be yourself, will get that image in the full uncropped size that it was originally taken in, and not the little 640 by 640 image that the standard extraction would give you if you did it through the Contacts application on the Mac side. So in any case, great suggestion with the PasteBot. I love that application, and I love the MacCast, and this is where you cut me off. Bye.
Hey, for the record, you cut yourself off at that point, so I wasn't going to cut you off. But I don't know how I missed that one. A couple of you had emailed me to say, hey, you know, you could just copy and paste that into an email and mail it to yourself, and then you would have the full resolution image. And yep, sometimes the simplest solution, maybe the most obvious solution, is the easiest one. So I kind of figured out this convoluted way using PasteBot, which is a really great application. So if you missed that that solution, go back and take a listen to that. But certainly this is a way to do it. And the only thing I don't like about this one is it always seems silly to me that you have to email a file from your device to yourself, to your own device, so that you can actually save it back onto your device. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't. That's why it's silly. It seems silly to do that, but absolutely would work. And thanks, Chris, and everybody else who followed up with that one. As we were discussing earlier this week, because of the release of Mountain Lion, or the announcement of Mountain Lion and the Gatekeeper technology, security has kind of come to the forefront, specifically security as it relates to Mac OS X applications. And Gatekeeper is going a long way to add a layer of security that you can kind of think of as like an ID check. You know, it's a check at the door. Hey, software, are you something that I want to allow to run on my operating system based upon who you are, where you came from? And, you know, this idea of this kind of identifier. There's another level of application security that's making its way into Mac OS X, specifically into Lion, even right now. And it's something that was brought forth with apps, specifically on the Mac App Store. And it's a technology called sandboxing. We have sandboxing. It's built into a lot of applications, built into iOS apps. It's built into Safari on the Mac desktop. And it's this idea that applications are kind of run within their own space, and they can't really necessarily just blanket break out of that space and do things on the operating system that we don't want to allow them to do. They're kind of in this little confined sandbox, and that's where they run. And Apple has a mandate for applications that are available on the Mac App Store that at a certain point, and the date's moved a couple times, at a certain point, applications sold through the Mac App Store are going to have to adhere to this sandboxing model. And if you want to know a little bit more about what all this stuff means, there is a great piece by developer Daniel Jalkut of Red Sweater Software. He's the guy who's responsible and wrote the great program Mars Edit, which I absolutely love for doing blogging and blog posts. But he has a great piece on his website where he talks about sandboxing and how it should work and some of the concerns and a little bit of how it relates to some of the announcements that Apple came out with respect to Gatekeeper. So I'll have a link to his piece in the show notes at maccast.com. But I wanted to go over sandboxing a little bit because I didn't really understand what it was, and I thought I'd share some of the things that I learned this week about it with you. And feel free, if you have some insights and some observations, to send your comments along as well. But in essence, what sandboxing does or should do is use this concept of entitlements. And it, rather than being this kind of ID check of saying, hey, can I run you? You know, are you from where I think you're from? Sandboxing takes this idea of actions, the things that an application can do, and asking for permission, or more specifically, an application defining, here's the things that I want to be able to do on your system, within the operating system, within, you know, how you're using the application, and are these things okay? So it's kind of a really specified, spelled out list of actions that the application might need perform. And this is the concept of this is something called entitlements. And so you entitle the application to do these things based on what's in that list. And they're clear descriptions of what the apps might want to do. For example, access the internet. I need access to the internet. Is that okay? I need to be able to read information from your address book, or I need to be able to access your iTunes library, or I need to be able to print or access your USB port. And so all of these things would be spelled out within the application, within the operating system. And when a developer writes them, they could insert these entitlements and then ask for permission, or the operating system would either give them permission or not permission to perform those kinds of actions. And so apps need to indicate which entitlements they plan to use, and then the operating system and hopefully ultimately the user would decide what they want to allow or not allow. Currently, all apps in the Mac App Store are required to implement sandboxing, this sandboxing concept and feature, by March 1st, 2012. The big issue right now, though, for developers, and something that's creating kind of some controversy, is that the list of entitlements that Apple has made available for developers is rather small, and Apple kind of decides what entitlements are allowed to be used. It's not something that the end user is in control of. And so that means that many applications on the Mac App Store would actually be severely crippled or actually rendered completely useless because the entitlements that they need literally aren't available. They can't do the things or access the areas of the operating system that they want because Apple hasn't made that kind of functionality available. So if a developer wants to sell their app through the Mac App Store and the entitlement's not available, then they really have no option. They kind of have to go outside the Mac App Store. And as you can see with how Apple's progressing with Mountain Lion, they're really starting to encourage users to use the Mac App Store. And they're kind of blessing the Mac App Store, since it's a curated environment, as the quote-unquote safe way for the average user to get their software. And so developers, I think, want to leverage that security, that kind of relationship that Apple's creating and the ease of use that Apple's creating, but without a broader list of entitlements and without some changes to how sandboxing is kind of handled, it's going to be particularly difficult for developers to do that. So in looking this week at how Gatekeeper works and how it's still controlled, but a little more open and definitely more user-centric in terms of the user gets to decide what level of access they want to allow applications to have, what kinds of IDs and what kinds of security that they're going to actually accept. There's some hope from developers that Apple may modify the current sandboxing strategy to allow for a few more options. The two biggest things that Apple could do would be significantly increasing the number and kinds of entitlements that they make available for developers to allow all the different kinds of things that we want to be able to do as users with our Macs and that developers want to implement into their Mac applications. And then more importantly, I think, is opening the sandboxing concept to applications that are sold outside the Mac App Store. And then along with that, creating some sort of control at the OS X level and some settings, a system preference, to allow us as end users to set and enforce what kinds of entitlements we want to allow for different applications. And whether that would be on kind of an operating system level or an application by application level, I don't really know. It'd be nice if it was a little bit more granular. But the point is that I can say, you know what, I'm okay allowing my applications to access the internet or to do location-based stuff, but I don't want to allow them to access, you know, files to be able to write stuff into my home user folder or my library folder or whatever the sort of restrictions that I might want to impose on different applications for my own personal settings. Some people might want a more open model. Some people might want a completely restricted model. And it would be great if there was sort of, just like they've done with Gatekeeper, a, you know, totally open, it can do anything. All right, I want it to only do things that Mac App Store apps can do. So I'll accept whatever restrictions that Apple wants to impose. Or nope, I want to have this custom controlled list of entitlements that I'm going to define, and I'm going to say this is what applications can do, and that's the mode that I want to run in, and then I can kind of tweak and customize it, sort of the power user mode of doing that. And I think that would be a great way for Apple to move forward with sandboxing and might get around some of the complaints that developers currently have with the current model. And as I mentioned before, the date got pushed back before so that developers could kind of get their applications ready. March 1st is fast approaching, and I think we might see another extension, or better yet, it'd be great if we'd see Apple tweak some of these settings and actually bring out some more controls for developers to take advantage of. I think these types of controls, though, this type of methodology would strike a really nice balance between ease of use, reasonable security, and still allow, you know, the ultimate control in the hands of users. I think it also would actively encourage developers to kind of support technologies like sandboxing, whereas right now they're kind of fighting against it because it forces them into a system that could potentially cripple or in some cases completely destroy the functionality of their applications. And I think we want security to move forward. We want it to become better. And we want technologies that are open and are going to enable that. And right now, as sandboxing is implemented by Apple, it seems much more restrictive and kind of locked into this App Store only model. So hopefully they'll change it. If you want to, again, read about this a little bit more in a little bit more detail from a developer's perspective, check out Daniel's article. And I guess somewhat related to this, something that really came to a head last week is this idea that, you know, we as users don't seem to be in enough control over our privacy and our security. In case you didn't hear about it, the social application Path, which is this app that allows you to share pictures and do status updates and things like that, you know, kind of like Twitter or any other file sharing services that are out there, they got in a little bit of hot water a couple weeks ago because it was discovered that they were uploading your entire contact database from your iOS application to their servers if you took advantage of their locate friends feature. So like a lot of applications, and Path was not the only application that was discovered to be doing this. Actually, a lot of applications are doing this where they have this feature that says, you've signed up for the service. If you want to locate other people on the service, we can use your address book to make those connections. Well, these applications, once you say okay to that, have been uploading, even though it's not totally obvious, they've been uploading all of your address book and contact data, the full contact database. And the real problem behind this, there's a couple problems with this. One, it's just a breach of your privacy. And two, though, it was done in a way where it wasn't really obvious that that's what the operating system was doing. And immediately after this happened, dozens of applications suddenly updated, pushed out software updates, and now they all implicitly ask and make it very clear when you say, yes, go ahead, find other people in my contacts database. They now pop up a message and say, hey, we're going to upload your contacts to our servers. Is this okay? And they should have been doing that all along. Actually, I'm going to talk about it in a minute, but I think there's even more that they can do. But Apple specifically responded to some questions after this whole thing came out from Congress asking about, you know, why was Apple allowing this to happen? What's going on here? And Apple pointed out that what these developers were doing is actually in direct violation of their policies. But, you know, at the same time, Apple's saying this, a lot of us are thinking, well, if these apps were violating that policy, isn't the whole point of your curated environment that you shouldn't have allowed these apps even into the Mac App Store? So obviously several points of failure happened here. But, you know, Apple's official statement was that apps that collect and transmit a user's contact data without the prior permission of the user are in violation of their guidelines, and that they also said that they were working to make some improvements to the customer experience to better protect the address book data, similar to the kinds of things that they did with location services. But here's the thing with me. There's absolutely no reason, in my opinion, that any of these developers ever needed access to your entire contacts list or your entire contact database. And there's certainly no reason they needed to completely upload the entire thing with all the phone numbers and all the other information to their databases. I really think this was just a lazy maneuver on the part of these developers. And I actually, frankly, question it because it creates a point of exposure for them. They suddenly have a bunch of my data that now they're assuming responsibility for. And, you know, in my opinion, they're almost at that point obligated to protect that. And if that information leaked out through their service, and I didn't know that they even had that data, it seems to me like they're opening themselves up for huge lawsuits. And in the kind of society we have now, that's just something you don't want to be doing. And they absolutely, in my opinion, do not need it to do the kinds of matching and provide the kinds of service and functionality that they're saying they want to provide. I mean, when you think about it, all they want to be able to do is know that if I use their service and you're a friend of mine and you use their service, they want to be able to connect the two of us together. And I spoke about this a little bit on the We Have Communicators podcast this week. It really is just lazy and irresponsible on the developer's part. And with or without any restrictions from Apple or whatever it is, they need to stop doing this kind of thing. It's exactly one of those areas where a technology like sandboxing, like I was talking about earlier, this concept of entitlements could really help, because I could define in my settings and say, you know what, I never want you to share my address book data with anyone. Just blanket, I want to block it. And if an application asks for that entitlement, just deny them that entitlement. They can't have that. But even without that, you know, developers should know better. And you can actually implement this kind of functionality fairly easily and do it in a way that would protect the privacy and security of the users. And so what you could do is you could generate a unique ID, and you could have that be something that's called a hash. Basically, you can take the data that's in the address book and encrypt it in a way and add in a technology called salting, for those of you who know what that is, and create a unique identifier that represents that data, but without any of the data itself. So you can combine information like an email address and some other information along with some random information, generate an ID using an algorithm that you can reproduce, and then upload that bit of data to your servers. It would not be identifiable. It would not be decryptable. It'd be basically a one-way encryption into a key. And all you would have to do, if you want to match my information with one of my friend's information, is encrypt that data in the same way. And if the two keys match, then you know that's a match between the two accounts. And you can say, hey, Adam, I see that your buddy Bob over here just started using the service. Do you want to hook up with him? And you can make that happen all without having to upload my address book and without putting yourself at risk, without putting my data at risk. And so, you know, developers need to wise up, but at the same time, you know, we need to also be more aware that this sort of thing is going on. And so it was great this past week seeing that this all came to light and developers have changed their policies. And hopefully moving forward, this is going to make a lot of them think twice about how brazen and brash they're being with our data. Now, at the same time, though, I'm one of those people that really thinks that ultimately we are the ones that are responsible for protecting this stuff, which is why I'm excited about technologies like Gatekeeper and maybe the potential of Apple giving us better control over the entitlements and sandboxing, because that puts us back in control of our own information and how that stuff is shared. So another great email I got this week came from Benjamin, and he asks, you know, do you think that people are becoming too trustworthy with Apple with their information? Because at the end of the day, you know, they're just another company. Do you think that becoming comfortable with Apple is a bad thing? With iCloud and some of the other technologies, we're giving up a lot of our data to companies like Apple, other services, Dropbox. And Benjamin asks the right question, is do any of these companies have our best interests at heart? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, no, they don't have our best interests at heart. Apple doesn't care about you or me or the next person. As much as we like to think that Apple is a better company, and I say that blanketly, you know, I think they do care, but it's definitely not the forefront of their mind. It's not the first thing that they think about when I'm uploading a document to iCloud, is, you know, I'm I'm worried about Adam's data. I'm going to ultimately protect his thing. I think they do think about it, but I think that trusting anyone else with the security of your personal information is a bad idea. Your privacy is something that you are ultimately solely responsible for, which is why I think it's bad when we don't have control, when things like this path thing happens unbeknownst to us. We don't know that it's going on. That is a problem. And that definitely needs to be addressed. But I think that companies like Apple also need to be responsible when they are building out these services. And even when they do it, though, with the best intentions, they make mistakes. And when your personal information is involved, my personal information is involved, and somebody else who's not me makes a mistake with that data, that can be really bad. And we see stories about it over and over again. Credit card company's database gets hacked and the information gets out there. You know, some restaurant has a bunch of data that they stored in an insecure way. And this happens all the time. Technology has not brought anything new to this equation other than the fact of how this information is stored, how it's passed around. It's easier. There's more of it out there, which is part of the problem. But all of the same concerns that existed back in the days when we were writing stuff down on paper, when it was going into filing cabinets. Who has access to that information? Is it locked up? The same kinds of things apply in the digital age. So these responsibilities are nothing, really nothing new. Digital just makes it easier to share that type of information and have different places where it's accessible. So the one thing that I would say to you about this information is stop and think before you start sharing this stuff. Most applications, and at least the good ones, are going to ask you before you share information. They're going to say, do you want to share your location? Is this okay? Do you want me to upload your entire address book fully unencrypted and store it on our servers, and we're going to keep a copy of that forever, and we're going to have access to everybody in your address book? Stop and think. Why do they need that information? What are they going to do with it? Why do they even need to have it in their database? And some don't ask. So make sure you do research. When someone tells you about a great new application, social application, ask yourself, what is it doing and why? What might be happening? Do a little bit of research, a little bit of Googling, find out what they're doing. And you can even email them directly. Check their website for their privacy policies. Check their website for FAQs that might say what they're doing with this information. Email them directly if you have concerns and just say, why do you need my address book data? What are you going to be doing with it? How do you protect it? Is another great question that you might want to ask. Don't just blindly click the yes box. So many people, so many of us have gotten used to just clicking. Click, 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 click. And the fiasco at Path with the contact data, I think, is a really good case in point and a really good example to point to and say, let's not let this happen again. Really consider what it means and what information is being shared. When you say yes to share your location, I also think that you need to assume, yes, they're absolutely going to be tracking you. If you say yes, you can have access to all of my contact information, all of the phone numbers, all of the email addresses. Assume the worst. Assume that they're going to do something bad with that data. And if you're not okay with that, then don't let them have it. Don't click that yes button. If you're uploading files, what information is in that file? If you're putting something on a cloud service, what's in that document? If that document got pulled off that server, if somebody hacked into that company's location, you might not know where it is. It could be on a server anywhere in the world. If someone got into that data center and stole that data, what would you be concerned about? What would be going through your head? Think about that before you put that information up on that server. And another thing that's hard to forget about is, or easy to forget about, excuse me, is metadata. A lot of our files now have extra information. You might have email addresses. For example, your iTunes music has, if you've bought it through the Mac App Store or the iTunes Store, has your Apple ID in it. It's embedded in the metadata information. When you take a photo with your digital camera or your iPhone, it might have your GPS location data in it. It's in there behind the scenes. So if you upload that photo to a photo sharing service and you don't implicitly remove that data or information, it's in there. So double check that the info isn't there before you share it. And after you've shared it, you might want to go to that service as a public user. If you've made that publicly available, don't log in. Just go as a random person and check and see what kinds of information you can access and make sure that you're okay with all of that type of information being shared. So bottom line is, I think good, responsible companies do have our best interests at heart and are going to take measures to protect our data. But I think you need to protect yourself. You need to assume that they don't care. And by taking that measure, then you're going to be protected and you don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about if Apple cares about your data because you do. You put your sensitive data in encrypted formats before you upload it. Leverage the tools that are built into your Mac. I've talked about how you can use Disk Utility and you can create an encrypted disk image. So if you can still put something up on a sharing website or create a backup of it and put it on an online backup service, but you encrypt it beforehand, even if the provider says, you know what, we encrypt the data, we're protecting it. If you want to be 100% sure and you want to know exactly the kind of encryption that's in place, do it yourself before you upload it. If you're going to put your photos up there, use tools that strip out the metadata before you upload them and then verify that that information is gone. You know, you need to be the one that's responsible for your own personal security and information. And I don't say that to be paranoid. I think there's a lot we can do and we can share information and we can do that stuff. But at the same time, Apple isn't going to be checking to make sure that you removed metadata from your photos. Apple's not going to be checking to make sure that that document that you put up into iCloud doesn't contain sensitive information like social security numbers or credit card numbers. They're going to let you upload it and put it in place. And whether or not they've put security measures on their end to protect it, there's no way you can know. You're not on the engineering team that implemented that. We can assume that Apple's a good company, but do you really want to let that information go out purely on an assumption? So that's just my opinion on it. You know, maybe it sounds a little bit paranoid, but I'd rather be paranoid and know that my information is protected than to run the risk of finding out after the fact that my personal information and data is out and being shared someplace where I didn't want it to be. And when exactly did this turn into a security show? I don't remember. You know, I think I've talked about the fact that when I'm prepping these shows, I don't actually plan it out, but sometimes they just naturally end up on a theme. And security and personal information and that sort of thing seems to have become a theme of this episode. But let's move on to something a little bit different. And this one is about iTunes match, or actually iTunes match not matching. Well, more of an iTunes match mismatch. Bruce noticed that his iTunes match had been kind of a mixed bag of good and bad experiences. And I have to say, having been using iTunes match and the service for a while now, I kind of agree with him. Here's specifically what he noticed. He noticed that there were several issues that he's run across. One, scrolling through his library is no longer smooth after enabling iTunes Match. He claims it's jittery. I haven't really noticed that one, but what I have noticed is that when you load your iTunes library, the music application, on iOS, there is a lot of network activity. You get the little kind of spinning progress network pinwheel up in the menu bar. And when that is going on, for sure, I noticed that scrolling is not as smooth. The whole interface kind of slows down a little bit while I believe it's kind of pulling down information. It specifically happens when you're playing a track that might be up in iTunes in the cloud, and it's actually downloading that as you play on your iOS device. So when it's pulling down album art and all the metadata and information, all that stuff is happening in the background, and that does actually seem to kind of affect scrolling. Another thing that Bruce noticed was that he said, when I listen to a song on my iPod 5G in sync, sometimes the last play field will be updated, but the play count will not be updated. And I assume you mean in iTunes. To me, this seems like it might be a syncing bug because the iPod 5G actually isn't, it has to be updated over the iTunes sync. So if the data in iTunes isn't matched up, maybe it's not coming down from iCloud. You also said that you noticed when you listen to a song on your iPhone, there's many times when there's no reflection of that play, and meaning that the play count or the last play date in iTunes doesn't seem to update on the Mac. And that also sometimes the play dates in your iTunes is over a year off. And I can actually confirm this bug, that the data doesn't seem to be updated from iCloud, which is supposed to be. And I seem to remember it working at one point where I could play a song on my iOS device and then the play count and the last play date would be updated in iTunes on my Mac. And I tried this after receiving your email, Bruce, and I noticed that in iTunes 10.5.3, it does not seem to be updating. So I'm not sure what's really going on there. And I think related to it, you also pointed out that changes to ID3 tags that you make in iTunes are sometimes reversed the next time that you open up the application. I haven't specifically noticed that one, but I did notice that updating ID3 tags, again, should update the information in iTunes in the cloud, and that doesn't seem to be 100% synchronizing for me. Another common problem with iTunes Match is sometimes the customized artwork on your files is replaced. I've noticed that with respect to re-downloading matched songs that are in iTunes. And I think the reason for that is I think it pulls down the album artwork that the iTunes store thinks is associated with that track. In a lot of cases, I have stuff that I've ripped myself, and in my local system, I've put in my own album art that I've either got from different locations or scanned in myself, and sometimes that album art does appear to be replaced with the stuff that's in the iTunes store. And I think that happens if you go and use the option that says get album artwork. I think that based on the metadata in the file, Apple does replace that artwork, and sometimes it's not the right stuff. The other thing that's been a common problem with iTunes and syncing since the very beginning, and I've never figured this one out, is sometimes you'll have album artwork that displays on your iOS devices that's completely wrong from the album art that's actually in the metadata of the file. So you can open that file on iTunes, you can look at the album art, and it'll be the right album art, but you'll be playing it on your iOS device, and suddenly you'll have... I've seen it even where podcast artwork will show up, like an iTunes artwork, album art will show up on a song that's totally not related to the MacCast, obviously. So I don't know why that happens, but that does seem to happen, and it just seems to naturally go away. I used to try and do the thing where I'd completely reset my library, basically remove all the music from my iOS device and then resync everything back on, and sometimes that would fix the album artwork, but... then it would just get messed up again. So that was just an exercise in futility. So I kind of stopped doing it. I guess you were also having problems with album art ratings disappearing. And you've had some songs that you're trying to match that have had a status of waiting and never really seeming to update with the iTunes service. I think that last one has to do with maybe some of the metadata or also sometimes corrupt local files, local audio files. I've had some success in just quitting iTunes or rebooting my Mac and then running the iTunes cloud update again and getting that stuff to kind of reset itself. Also, just playing around with metadata, changing some metadata in those files and then resubmitting them to iTunes in the cloud to get matched again, sometimes can fix things up. So I would play around, you know, do get info on those files and look in there and play around with that a little bit. But yeah, iTunes Match is kind of feeling like it's not 100% finished. I think mostly it works. I ended up at one point with a bunch of duplicate files in my system. The good news there was I was able to just kind of delete off the duplicates, knowing that I already had copies up in the cloud. So if I needed to, I could just re-download them. In general, I'm kind of liking iTunes Match, but you know, I don't know how I feel about some of the stuff we talked about on the last episode about where it says it's streaming on my Mac and it's not really streaming. It's kind of progressively downloading into some temporary files that are kind of hidden in the background. Things like that are kind of more bothering me than some of these little quirky buggy things. I think a lot of this buggy stuff, especially with respect to metadata and how it's syncing things up, hopefully that's something that Apple will work out. And I do think that some of the bugs and issues specifically related to play counts and last play dates were introduced in the latest iTunes update, the 10.5.3. So hopefully with 10.5.4, Apple will refix those. But if anybody else has encountered, any of the rest of you have encountered these types of problems that Bruce is noting and happen to have fixes, please let us know. Send me some email, maccast@gmail.com. Something that's kind of looming on us is going to be coming up this summer is the death of MobileMe, and specifically of some services that are in MobileMe that didn't make their way to iCloud. We've talked a little bit about photo galleries, that service going away, and some of the alternatives, things like Flickr or Picasa. We've talked about iWeb hosting and some alternatives to that, getting your own hosting plan, going with uploading from iWeb through FTP to get that up onto your servers, maybe using something like RapidWeaver, some of the other tools that are out there, Sandvox, to replace iWeb. And iWeb's actually not going away in and of itself. You can continue to use that. And we've talked about that. So those are some of the services. But one of the ones that we hadn't talked too much about yet is Keychain and Keychain syncing specifically. And I got this question this week from Lauren.
Hi, Adam. This is Laurin from Innsbruck, Austria, longtime listener of the MacCast. Enjoy it very much. I have a question about the move from MobileMe to iCloud. I've been holding off moving from MobileMe to iCloud, especially for the reason that the Keychain synchronization just doesn't seem to be there in iCloud anymore. I've been looking for third-party alternatives, searching around for the last couple of weeks, and didn't really find any satisfactory answer. So that's my question to you now. First of all, how do you synchronize your keychains? Because I'm assuming you do. And secondly, do you know of any third-party alternative that I could probably employ for having this feature, although MobileMe is going to be gone by July. All right. Looking forward to your answer. Thank you.
I hope after you hear it, you still look forward to my answer, because I don't know that I have the perfect solution for this. I can tell you what I've been using and what I do. The syncing with respect to if I have multiple computers and I have passwords and stuff stored in my keychain on Mac OS X currently, and I sync my keychain through the MobileMe service, what's great is that's automatic. If I put a password into one Mac and it syncs over to another one, and now I need to go access a service, it's already in the keychain. Assuming I've already logged in and unlocked that keychain, now that service is going to have access to that password. That kind of seamless syncing between Macs, I don't have a really good solution for. So if anybody does have one that I'm not aware of, please let myself and Lauren know. But what I use now is a pseudo way of kind of syncing, and it's a little bit manual, and it's 1Password. I'm a huge 1Password fan, a 1Password user. I keep all of my logins and passwords in 1Password, and I combine that with Dropbox, the Dropbox service, and I use that to sync 1Password between all of my Macs, all of my iOS devices. Everything ties into that 1Password database that's stored up in Dropbox. And kind of keeping in the theme that we were talking about earlier, that file is actually encrypted before it goes up to Dropbox. So for those of you who are wondering, 1Password uses its own encryption scheme, and so the file that's stored on Dropbox is already pre-encrypted. And it gets even better, because 1Password, when I need to access any individual item that's within 1Password inside of it, each little password, it's my understanding, is encrypted. And I only, when I decrypt something or need to get information out of it, it only decrypts that one item at a time. So that protects the majority of the 1Password database, even when you're doing decryption to kind of extract information temporarily. And then once you're out of 1Password, it re-encrypts everything and everything's kept secure. So it's a really good, secure system. But the one thing that it's not really offering me is this kind of seamless synchronization. So what happens is, in my case, is I have everything stored in the 1Password database. I have my one Mac that I'm working on. Say I set up a new password, and say it's something that I want to store for whatever reason in the Mac OS X keychain locally. That functionality is not going away with MobileMe. It's only the syncing. So I can still have my password. I can log in. I can check the checkbox that says, okay, go ahead and save this into my keychain on this Mac. And then that Mac will have access to it as long as I'm logged into my account. But now I go to another Mac where I have an account, and I need to log into the same service, say an FTP server or something like that, and I want to store that password in the keychain. Well, now what I can do is I can open up 1Password, I can get the password out of there, enter my login credentials into that other Mac. I don't have to remember the password because it's stored in 1Password. Can plug it into the FTP client on my second Mac, and then again check the checkbox and say, I want to store this locally in this keychain. So in that way, I'm kind of manually replicating from one keychain to another and saving it, but I'm not really syncing the two. So that's what I do. I don't know if that's the kind of solution that you're looking for, Lauren, but barring any other solution from somebody else, that's the only way that I know how to do it. And I've asked a couple of people about this as well, and the 1Password Dropbox method seems to be what most of us are using. And so the last thing that I have for you today is a little tip, and this was kind of cool. It was something pointed out by iLounge, and it makes absolute sense once you realize that the operating system that iOS does this, but it was something that I had not noticed until it was actually pointed out to me, so I will point it out to you as well. And it has to do with iOS and the split keyboard, which I believe was introduced in iOS 5. I don't think it was in there in 4. Whenever the split keyboard was introduced, and that's the ability to, you know, you can kind of take two thumbs and you can pull the keyboard apart and get it split. It's great on the iPad, especially if you have it in landscape mode and you need to do typing. You can actually do thumb typing, kind of hold on to the edges. It also has that little handle that you can kind of pull up and split, or you can click and hold and say split the keyboard. But when you're doing that, you kind of have one batch of keys on the left side and one batch of keys on the right side, and they're all reachable by your thumb. So the idea is you'd be doing kind of some thumb typing. And if you go too far past the last key in either row on either side, so either all the way over to the left or all the way over to the right, depending upon which thumb that you're looking at, what you'll find is the key that's to the left or to the right of the visible one, the one that's way over on the other side of the keyboard, is actually also there just to the left or right of the physical key on the other side, but it's invisible. And it's kind of hard to describe, but just imagine that if you're looking at the keys and you have the US keyboard and it's split on your screen, on the left-hand side, the top row ends with the letter T, and then on the right-hand side, it ends with the letter Y as you move toward the center of the screen. Well, if you tap just to the left of the Y, you'll notice it'll actually type a T, even though that physical T key is all the way over on the other side of the screen. Same thing to the right of the T. If you tap just to the right of the T, it will actually type a Y, which is way over on the other side of the screen. So they actually have their companion mate invisible just to the left or right of them, depending on the key. And that's true for the T and the G and the V on the left-hand side of the US keyboard, and the Y and the H and the B on the right-hand side of the US keyboard. So you might have to play around with this to actually get it. Again, it's really kind of hard to describe in audio, but it allows you to mistakenly use the wrong thumb on the wrong side of the keyboard and kind of go a little bit too far over and still get the right desired result when you're typing. And it absolutely made sense that Apple would design it that way. It kind of relates to some of the predictive typing stuff that they do. But it was interesting that iLounge pointed that out, and I had never really noticed that before. So a little trick that you can check out on your iOS keyboards. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as trials over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, be sure to check out Notebook. They have free trials available, as well as more information, some great tutorials up on their website. Check it out at CircusPonies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. If you haven't had a chance to check it out, they just came out with PDF Pen for the iPad. Absolutely awesome. They have more information, details, as well as trials of their Mac applications up on their website at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, great place to go get cash for your old electronics. You know, iPad 3 is looming. If you want to get some cash for that iPad 2 now, you might want to check it out on Gazelle. Gazelle.com is the place. You can do a simple search. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support of the show. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. If you have a question, a comment, anything you'd like to hear maybe on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail message. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you'd prefer to leave voicemail on Skype, you can use the Skype address, the MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, and that's at MacCast.com. Or you can also check out the forum that's at forum.maccast.com, great online community of MacCast listeners. A bunch of people hang out there and help each other out, answer questions. It's a lot of fun and free to sign up for a MacCast forum account. So if you haven't done that in the past, I encourage you to check that out. Also, if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, that's at twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page, and that's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. So thanks for hanging out with me once again, and until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.